Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Lies of the Land, Seeing Rural America for What It Is and Isn't, by Stephen Kahn, narrated by Tom Perkins. Preface. That empty feeling. A book about rural America is preposterous on its face. There is no such thing as rural America because there are many rural Americas, each with its own history, culture, and dynamics. There are rurals in every state and in every region of the country. Rural Americans come, just like urban Americans, in every stripe and flavor, politically, ethnically, religiously. Quebecois timber workers in northern Maine, shrimpers from Southeast Asia in coastal Louisiana, Central American slaughterhouse workers in rural Iowa and Kansas, and, of course, Native American reservation land remains overwhelmingly rural. We know from the novels of Willa Cather and Sinclair Lewis, from the diary of Rachel Kalloff and other such sources, that women have long experienced rural life differently than men and have often felt its hardships more acutely, and still do. Economically, rural America relies on agriculture, and it relies on extractive and manufacturing industries. It also depends on tourism and recreation. Depending on where you look, rural America is either desperately poor or awash in money. Any list of the nation's poorest counties includes mostly rural ones, places like Wheeler County, Georgia, and McCreary County, Kentucky. At the same time, Teton County, Wyoming, inhabited at a sparse 5 people per square mile, can stake a claim to being both the wealthiest in the country, home to some of America's super-rich, and the place with the nation's most yawning wealth gap. No single book, no single word could pretend to do justice to all that diversity of experience. Likewise, there have been any number of attempts to define exactly what rural America is in the first place. Researchers at Ohio State University recently announced 5 different kinds of rural in Ohio alone. Once, rural people were classified on the basis of the work they did, the assumption being that those people made their living directly from the land in one way or another. That is certainly not true anymore, and it hasn't been for some decades. Rural people drive long-haul trucks, and they work for the state or county, though many might explain that this isn't the same as working for the government, and some commute long distances for office or factory work in a metropolitan area. In 1987, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation funded the National Rural Studies Committee to promote the study of rural America. Yet, even this group of scholars struggled with the term rural and wound up using rural, non-metropolitan, countryside, and hinterlands, more or less synonymously. John Fraser Hart, a geographer who was on the committee, turned the definitional dilemma into something of an inadvertent koan. The need to understand and define the concept of rural becomes all the more urgent as that concept becomes ever less clear. At roughly the same time, the Bureau of the Census had more or less given up altogether, deciding that rural meant anything left over after counting urban and metropolitan regions. The urban population consists of all persons living in urbanized areas and in places of 2,500 or more inhabitants, the Bureau announced in 1985. All other population is classified as rural. The welter of definitions and the very precision they struggle to achieve underscores their arbitrariness in the first place. I'll say here that I have neither fixed on one definition nor attempted my own, though the bulk of this book focuses on the space between the Appalachians and the Sierras. This space includes much of what is commonly considered rural America, though certainly not all of it. Still, most of us feel a rural place when we stand in one or when we drive through it. The spaces are bigger, the traffic is lighter, the houses fewer and farther between. We have the sensation, an illusion, really, of leaving all the artifice of the urban behind and entering something closer to nature. We can find ourselves alone, or nearly so. Indeed, that's often the reason metropolitans go out to the country in the first place. I took my first trip to China in the summer of 1997, and among my most vivid memories of it are the countryside as I traveled between China's big cities. Rural China struck me as a vastly different place than rural America, because it bustled with people and activity. Chinese agriculture, I quickly came to see, remained small-scale and thus still relied on human and other animal labor to wrest food from the land. In this sense, rural China seemed the opposite of rural America, where fewer than 2% of us are now engaged in agriculture. I shared these memories with a dear friend from China. She responded that many who come to the United States from China refer to it as the Big Empty. For the Chinese people, she went on to explain, the place feels like there's no one there. Accustomed to sharing a country roughly the same size as the United States with approximately 4 times as many people, many in China find much of this country to be almost literally disembodied. The lack of people strikes them as quintessentially American. Maybe that's pop psychology, but the phrase sticks with me. The Big Empty seems as good a label for rural America as any developed by demographers, sociologists, political pundits, or anyone else. It captures something both literal, there aren't many people there, and more visceral about the way it feels to be in a rural place. More than that, it describes the cultural expectation that so many Americans, few of whom actually live in rural America anymore, seem to have of what rural means. Spacious rather than crowded, natural rather than artificial, the opposite of urban. And it applies equally to the vast variety of rural places in this country. However else Kansas wheat farms, North Dakota fracking operations, southern cotton fields, and denuded Appalachian coal country may differ, to stand in any one of them is to feel the emptiness and to know that you are in a rural place. There is something contradictory or even paradoxical about that empty feeling. The evidence of human activity in all those places is easy enough to see. In fact, those places are no less shaped by our ambitions and desires, technology and greed, than any city skyline. We just rarely see the people responsible for this shaping, because there are so few of them, or because they are somewhere else. Far from being local and small-scale, the forces at work on these landscapes are usually huge and remote. It takes only a solitary driver piloting a combine, roughly the size of a 2-story house, to gobble up hundreds and hundreds of acres of that Kansas wheat. He may own that land, or he might rent it from some distant absentee landlord. But either way, he's paying constant attention to wheat prices in Chicago or some other global commodities market as his GPS pilots the highly sophisticated piece of farm technology with a precision that would have made the Apollo crews envious. Yet to watch him, he appears solitary, out there all alone. That sense of emptiness obscures. It prevents us from seeing what is really at work in rural America, and it veils what has been hiding in plain sight. Introduction. Crisis and Myth. Today the rural mind begins to retake its earlier place as the dominant American mind. Charles Morrow Wilson, 1940. When we talk about rural America, we find ourselves caught between the language of crisis and the language of myth. The two languages mirror each other. We can measure a crisis by how far it seems to carry us away from an imagined idea of normal, that is, from a myth. John Brinkerhoff Jackson, one of our foremost writers about landscapes, noted some time ago that when Americans look at a particular landscape, we tend to see it not as it is, with its own unique character, but as a degenerate version of the traditional landscape. We look, Jackson asserted, and what we see is a long, drawn-out backsliding. Trapped in this circular discourse, we haven't been able to see rural America as clearly as we ought to, and we have been blinded to do things as they are. But we can think differently about the rural. We can sidestep the tropes of crisis and myth by looking instead at how 4 of the major forces that propel modern America have shaped rural spaces to the same extent as they have formed the rest of the country, and especially since the end of World War II: militarization, industrialization, corporatization, and suburbanization. These forces aren't discrete or independent from one another, and there is considerable overlap among them. But we can see rural spaces and those who live in them more clearly if we look military bases, not family farms. national corporations rather than Main Street shops, the rural world as it actually is rather than what we expect it to be. But first, I want to dispense with the ideas of crisis and myth. No word has been used more consistently to describe rural America than crisis, and a perpetual sense of crisis has driven our attempts to understand and address what is going on in rural places in study after study, report after report, and policy prescription after policy prescription for at least a century. The DNA of that crisis has also been remarkably unchanging. Economic and social decline, backsliding, twine around each other to create a sense that something has gone wrong, whether in the 1880s, the 1930s, the 1980s, or today. In recent years, opioid addiction has been the symbol of that ceaseless sense of rural crisis, and opioids have indeed wreaked a grim toll disproportionately in rural America. I live and work in rural Ohio, which can stake a claim to being the epicenter of the scourge, and I've had students squabble with a kind of gallows humor over which of their towns truly deserves the title Heroin Heartland. Overdoses, too numerous for rural health systems to handle, have gone hand in glove with suicides, as rural Americans now take their own lives at significantly higher rates than those in metropolitan parts of the nation. Suicide is a complicated, enigmatic phenomenon, but it appears that some combination of the very things that rural people extol about rural life, the isolation, the perceived self-reliance, and the easy availability of guns, is precisely what makes suicide more common in those places. The opioid crisis eclipsed the crystal meth crisis of just a few years earlier, at least in the public imagination, but that too was a preponderantly rural phenomenon. According to one journalist, meth appeals to a rural constituency because it's cheap, easy to manufacture at home, and requires no special equipment or expertise. Not for nothing has crystal meth been called hillbilly cocaine. As the national media covered those deaths of despair, to use the words of the economists Ann Case and Angus Deaton, and the rural communities torn apart by them, those stories also exposed anew an economic crisis. Routinely, we hear that rural places have been left behind, cut off from the rest of society by the lack of something, most recently high-speed internet or adequate transportation networks. Without these, they fail to attract jobs in our post-industrial and post-agricultural creative class economy. Pundits and policymakers wring their hands, whether looking at rural Kentucky or South Dakota or Nebraska, wondering if a lack of good jobs drives the young and the talented away from rural and small-town America, or does a lack of young talent keep the jobs away? Either way, the result is clear in the data. Rural areas are getting older. Rural areas are getting less education. Rural areas continue to lose population. During the pandemic, COVID-19 infections and deaths replaced heroin overdoses on the front pages, exposing yet again the crisis of rural health care. Local and even regional hospitals have been closing in rural areas for some years, sometimes merged with larger facilities and sometimes not, all in the name of pursuing health care efficiencies, which efficiently leave more and more rural residents without access to an ER. As a result of all that, rural America grows angrier at the rest of us. All this despair and neglect, the accumulated suffering and hopelessness boiled over with the election of 2016, we're told. Donald Trump channeled the anger and the fears and the frustrations of rural voters who propelled him into the White House. Whether or not that narrative really explains the election results is beside the point. Rural America seemed to have become the kingmaker, and now the rest of the country had to sit up and take notice. The problems are all real enough. The overdoses and the aging population and the abandoned storefronts along Main Street in so many small towns. But the word crisis is not, I think, the right one to use to describe all this suffering and sorrow. Crisis means a period of intense difficulty or challenge, like the Cuban Missile Crisis or Suez Crisis. It interrupts the normal state of affairs and, most important, a crisis comes to an end, for better or for worse. In this sense, rural America isn't in crisis today. Its condition is, more accurately put, chronic. Its history sounds a consistent refrain. Rural America is in crisis, and something must be done about it. You can find those laments in the 1880s and in the 1980s and 2010s, and in almost every decade in between. People have described rural America as being in a crisis of one sort or another almost continuously for nearly a century and a half. The first version of the refrain came shortly after the Civil War, when the original populist movement grabbed the nation's attention. Farmers, angry at an economic system they felt had ruined their livelihoods, organized themselves into a potent political force, especially in the midsection of the country. That crisis, in turn, generated the first national study of rural problems and the first set of proposals designed to address the rural crisis. President Theodore Roosevelt created the Country Life Commission in 1908, and its chair, Liberty Hyde Bailey, described the goal of the Country Life movement as the working out of the desire to make rural civilization as effective and satisfying as other civilizations. Implicit in that statement, of course, is that by the early 20th century, rural civilization had somehow already been left behind. By the time the commission issued its report in 1911, conditions in many rural places had gotten much better. Urban growth, and especially economic demand during World War I, drove up commodity prices for everything from Kansas wheat and Mississippi cotton to Kentucky coal and Oklahoma lead. But even high prices couldn't keep the kids down on the farm, and the crisis morphed from an economic one to a social one. Many commentators expressed shock and concern at the data from the census of 1910, which revealed that a significant number of rural counties had lost population, and those people who stayed were growing older. In one of these counties in Missouri, school children constituted 31% of the population in 1890. By 1910, that had dropped to 26%. The population of Bosworth, Missouri, founded in 1888 in the north-central part of the state, peaked in 1910 and has been declining ever since. Meanwhile, labor violence in rural mining regions had become distressingly common as miners found themselves beleaguered and abused and tried to fight back against large mining companies. Some of the names are familiar, others perhaps are not. Lethal violence erupted in all of them. Latimer, Pennsylvania, 1897. Verdon, Illinois, 1898. Paint Creek, West Virginia, 1912. Ludlow, Colorado, 1914. Matawan, West Virginia, 1920. Herron, Illinois, 1922. The Country Life Commission wasn't much interested in these corners of rural America, and even today we don't necessarily think of the almost continuous violence and repression in mining country as a rural crisis, because striking miners have not carried much rural resonance for us. Indeed, part of the problem of seeing rural America clearly stems from the fact that we tend to equate rural with farm, thus ignoring other kinds of rural places. But we ought to acknowledge those miners. They were rural people in rural places, and their lives were as desperate as that of any populist farmer. Back on the farm, high commodities prices didn't last much longer than the populist movement did. They collapsed after World War I, and agricultural America found itself in crisis again. During the interwar decades, the mechanization and consolidation of agriculture started in earnest. It did so in mining as well. Employment in the nation's coal mines topped out in the 1920s and has been declining ever since. These changes in farming, from small scale to ever bigger and reliant more and more on industrial technology, contributed to the fact that by 1940, nearly half of all farms in the country were tenant farms, up from 35% 40 years earlier. Thomas Jefferson, champion of the land-owning yeoman farmer, was rolling over in his grave. The Great Depression forced many Americans to confront poverty to an extent that they had never done before, and the New Deal responded, at least in part, with a dizzying number of programs to ameliorate it. In fact, though, many New Dealers, and President Franklin Roosevelt most of all, were concerned primarily with rural poverty. In 1935, the Works Progress Administration's Division of Social Research identified six problem areas in rural America. 1. The Appalachian Ozark area. 2. The Lake States cutover area. 3. The spring wheat area. 4. The winter wheat area. 5. The eastern cotton belt. And 6. The western cotton belt. Though there were commonalities across these regions, the researchers acknowledged that each of the areas presents a distinctive set of social and economic problems which must be taken into consideration in planning a program of rehabilitation. This New Deal conceptualization did not claim to be comprehensive. The geographic regions marked in 1935 didn't include any of the rural areas west of the Rockies, nor did it look at the grinding poverty found across much of rural New England. Still, this six-part taxonomy reveals an assumption as true then as it is now. We conceive of rural in relation to how the land gets used, to the resources produced by it. Four of these six name specific and predominant crops, cotton and wheat, while the other two denote areas that had been logged over, mined to death, or both. Rural carries with it the expectation that people live and work more directly with the land than the rest of us. Except that the connection between rural work and rural land was already fraying in the 1930s, and the pace of that fraying accelerated after World War II. Between 1950 and 1970, the total number of farms continued to decline, this time by roughly 50%, while the average size of a farm nearly doubled from 205 to 400 acres. No surprise that the number of people living on farms declined from about 20 million to fewer than 10 million during those two decades. Then came the farm crisis of the 1980s, from which rural America, certainly agricultural America, has arguably never fully recovered. Profitability has gone up and down in agriculture, and in mining too, but the number of people who make their livelihood that way has only gone down, a trend observers started noting early in the 20th century. The semantics here matter. Describing rural America as in crisis implies, as I've suggested, that there was a normal, healthy, and stable situation from which we have deviated and to which we ought to return. But that, needless to say, raises the question of just when rural America was normal. When exactly was rural America great? When the writer Dan Schultz returned to the small towns of his Missouri youth, he found them uniformly drab. He acknowledged that life wasn't beautiful when he was growing up, but now those towns had collapsed into ugliness of soul and body. He took that trip in 1962 and was looking back on the 1930s. Like those mythological turtles, in our stories of rural America, it seems to be declension all the way down. One could conclude that not only was rural America never the heart or the backbone or whatever other piece of the national anatomy, it has not been the mainstream of our national life for nearly two centuries. Certainly, the agricultural economy has been out of sync with the national economy more often than not since the end of the Civil War. The journalist Charles Morrow Wilson noted this as long ago as 1940 when he lamented, "We are beginning to realize that the United States is now out of step with the deliberate saunter of rural life." Notice the nifty inversion. It is the majority of the country that is out of step. The word saunter is a nice touch, too, implying that rural life is lived at a relaxed, easygoing, almost Thoreauvian pace, not the hurried, desperate rush with which, say, so many farm families fled the grain belt during the Great Depression. The farm crisis of the late 19th century happened as the urban industrial economy boomed. The collapse of farm prices after World War I happened during what F. Scott Fitzgerald characterized as the greatest, gaudiest spree in history. The Depression certainly had a leveling effect on both urban and rural areas. But in the cities, things went from good to bad. In rural America, they went from bad to worse. Nearly 4 in 10 residents of South Dakota, one of the most rural states in the Union, went on New Deal relief during the Great Depression, the highest percentage in the nation. World War II revived both industry and agriculture, but afterward the pattern resumed. Farm country in particular did not enjoy the post-war boom to the same extent that the rest of suburbanizing white-collar America did. In 1967, to take one data point, a presidential commission found that 14 million rural Americans lived in poverty. "Rural poverty is so widespread," the commission wrote, "and so acute as to be a national disgrace." The commission titled its report, "The People Left Behind," a phrase and a phenomenon that has echoed over the decades. Conversely, during the stagflation years of the 1970s, while many Americans struggled with inflation and unemployment, some farmers did pretty well. Farm prices reached 71% of parity, an aspirational price for each commodity set by the USDA based on a complicated formula. By 1979, driven by export demand and access to easy money, both dried up after 1980. But during Ronald Reagan's go-go 1980s, when Ivan Boesky told us that greed was good, the farm economy tanked even as farmers continued to cheer Reagan himself. After helping to re-elect Reagan to a second term, farmers became charity cases in 1985. Inspired by the Live Aid Music Festival to benefit Ethiopian famine victims, Willie Nelson co-organized Farm Aid to raise money for families losing their farms. The next year, farm prices dropped to 51% of parity, a level not seen in farm country since the depths of the Great Depression. The Farm Aid project continues to this day, and the current rural crisis unfolded amid the longest economic recovery the nation has ever experienced. Crisis, then, simply won't do. What rural America has experienced over the last century and a half is the norm, sad though that may be. Far from being real America, therefore, we might conclude that rural American life has increasingly been the outlier since the mid-19th century, despite how many of us continue to believe otherwise. That unacknowledged contradiction, that yearning for a good old days, I think, lies at the heart of the way we have talked about rural America, a discourse that has alternated for decades between angry nostalgia and aggrieved despair. It still does. As a student in one of my classes wonderfully put it, nostalgia is a dangerous drug. The nature of that nostalgia is what has trapped us in the language of crisis and decline. For many people, that nostalgia may be fixed to some very specific local experience, a family farm lost to creditors, or the high school of one's youth closed for lack of enrollment. But at a larger cultural level, that nostalgia is for an imagined time and place, a projection of cultural desires and expectations. Rural decline must be measured against the image of what we have, at various moments, thought rural America ought to be, as much as against what it actually has been. Rural crisis is thus inextricably linked to our agrarian myths and pastoral ideals. In 1955, Richard Hofstadter elaborated on the agrarian myth in his Pulitzer Prize-winning The Age of Reform. The hero of the myth, as he described it, was the Jeffersonian yeoman, who was considered the ideal man and the ideal citizen. Living in close communication with the beneficent nature, Hofstadter went on, gave the yeoman wholesomeness and integrity that could not be found among city dwellers. More than a way of life, the agrarian myth posited a moral proposition. Rural life was essentially religious, as the yeoman was seen to be the central source of civic virtue. But where did the myth come from? Not the small farms it extolled. "In origin," Hofstadter wrote, "the agrarian myth was not a popular but a literary idea, a preoccupation of the upper classes, of those who enjoyed a classical education, read pastoral poetry, experimented with breeding stock, and owned plantations or country estates." Which is a pretty deft description of Thomas Jefferson himself, a founding father of the agrarian ideal. There is a country mile between our rural mythologizing and rural reality, though it hasn't seemed to have mattered much to our public discussions. American pioneers and homesteaders, far from being anchored to the land like they were supposed to be, were restless and expansive and mobile, perhaps even more so in the 19th century than in the 20th. Nor did they offer a virtuous bulwark against the rising tide of commercialism said to be corrupting American cities. Rural people were market-oriented, commercially driven, and financially savvy from the very outset of the Republic. As the historian Christopher Clark has observed in the early 19th century, farming...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?